Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management, Mellon.com, and by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here's the question when you come right down to it. If enough people say things are okay, are things really okay? And would it help if those people are named Hank and Ben? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. And by Bank of America, through community outreach, philanthropic giving, and environmental efforts, finding opportunity and embracing it. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity, bankofamerica.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on this Tuesday. It's August 21st. And you know, there's nothing touchy-feely about Wall Street. Either you win on a trade or you lose. Money in your pocket or in somebody else's. And now that we're a couple of trading days past the Federal Reserve's cut in the discount rate, investors are starting to wonder what's next for them. So far, nothing quantitative, nothing they can trade on, but Marketplace's Bob Moon reports there were some subtle signs the ground under Wall Street might be a little more stable.
The message didn't really change today, but it might finally be getting through. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson reiterated this is going to take a while to play out. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke is still promising to be vigilant. What has changed is the visibility of the men offering those reassurances, in particular Mr. Bernanke. Today, the Fed chief and the Treasury Secretary went to Capitol Hill. They met with Senate Banking Committee Chairman Christopher Dodd. He told reporters, and perhaps more importantly, the banking industry and investors, that he was cheered by a promise. From Bernanke.
I asked the chairman of the Fed whether or not he was willing to use all the tools available to him. He said he was prepared to do that. Absolutely is the language he used, and I applaud that.
At the same time, the Treasury Secretary declared he has great confidence in the Fed. Words like that might be worth as much or more than the $119 billion the Fed has pumped into the banking system so far this month. Kenneth Thomas lectures in finance at the Wharton School of Business. He says the rookie Fed chairman seems to be emerging from a credit crunch of a different kind, a lack of trust he's faced from investors.
They realize that Bernanke realizes that it really is a serious situation. As he gets more experience in this role, he'll realize that confidence, perception, those are the things that matter the most in financial markets.
If it's true the fundamental underpinnings of the economy are sound, Thomas suggests Wall Street might just need more confidence in the messenger. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
I got home from work yesterday, went straight to the mailbox as I always do. Once I got past all the flyers and advertising supplements, I started plowing through the rest of the junk mail, and I opened this. An invitation from Countrywide to apply for a 40-year mortgage, pointing out that it would offer low monthly payments and that they've approved 4 out of every 5 applicants they've gotten. Of course, that piqued my interest, seeing as how Countrywide's reported to be teetering on the brink of bankruptcy. So we went looking for a mortgage broker to talk to. Seth Asher is with MyLoanMarket.com. Seth, good to talk to you.
My pleasure.
All right, so what happens if I take Countrywide up on its very kind offer for a 40-year loan, and in, I don't know, a month, month and a half, they go belly up?
Well, it really depends where you are in the application process. If you haven't actually funded the loan yet, then chances are you're going to get your application kicked out. If they're belly up, they can't perform on the funding of the loan, and you'll have to go elsewhere to get your loan.
What if I have closed and everything's fine and I've been making payments for a month or two?
Then you should have no problem. You might experience a little discomfort not knowing where to send your check if they haven't sold off the loan. sometimes they keep loans on their books, but oftentimes after about a month, they'll sell the loans and they get packaged, become mortgage-backed securities.
Right, and we all know how that turns out. But here's the thing. It's my house, and I don't want discomfort with my mortgage. I want to know that where I'm sending it is the place it's supposed to be.
Yeah, and that could affect a large number of consumers out there because, obviously, Countrywide's a huge company. A lot of people have Countrywide loans, and there may be no way to avoid that discomfort.
Back to this letter from Countrywide. Obviously, if they're going to weather this storm they're having, they have to keep selling into the crisis to generate the business, right?
Yes, they have to, absolutely.
And your professional opinion on how that's going to go for them?
they've made a lot of silly loans in the past. They've got to really strike the right balance between being aggressive enough to be able to do loans that need to be done in today's marketplace, yet not take too much risk like they seem to have done in the past, which is apparent since they have had a fair number of loans go bad, which has brought them close to insolvency or bankruptcy, whatever the rumor of the day is.
Fine line, though, right, between taking the risk that's going to make you a little bit of extra money and playing it safe and maybe not getting enough in return.
It is really a fine line, and it's up to the senior management of that organization to really strike that balance. And it's especially difficult with such a large ship like Countrywide to make all the right critical choices.
How worried are you if Countrywide should not be able to work itself out? I mean, it makes one out of every five loans in this country.
Sure. And not only is it one out of every five loans, but also just the ripple effect of one other catastrophe in the mortgage industry will have an effect on the appetite for loans for the remaining lenders in the marketplace.
Seth Asher is a mortgage broker at MyLoanMarket.com. Seth, thanks a lot.
It's my pleasure.
There were two other developments today in the land of subprime that might interest you. The research firm RealtyTrack reports foreclosures are up 93% from this time a year ago. And the independent mortgage company First Magnus filed for bankruptcy today. It stopped funding loans and laid off 6,000 workers last Thursday. It had been number 16 on the list of largest mortgage lenders in this country. Number one on that list, Countrywide, has been running full-page ads in major papers trying to reassure its customers that everything's fine. One of those papers is the Los Angeles Times, which finds itself in the news. Today, shareholders of the Tribune Company, which owns the Times, voted to approve an offer to take the company private. The yes side got 97% of the vote. Not too surprising since the deal will pay them $34 a share. After a 3% spike today, Tribune closed at $28. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli reports timing is everything.
It's been almost a year since Chicago's Tribune Corporation put itself up for sale. Ad revenues at the troubled media company were tanking, and newspaper circulation was going south. To the rescue came billionaire real estate mogul Sam Zell. Back in April, the Chicago native cooked up a rescue plan. It meant taking the company private and securing massive loans. What a difference 5 months can make.
Months ago, when this deal was struck, it was a go-go market.
That's Chris Donnelly of Standard & Poor's.
You could finance just about anything, and people tried to.
The enterprising Zell managed to convince four banks to pony up $8 billion worth of loans to launch the complex deal, with another $4 billion needed to complete it. Investors aren't so keen about that debt anymore. Aside from the obvious credit crunch, they've soured on Tribune because an already dire situation for the newspaper business keeps on getting worse. Newspaper analyst Ken Doctor says operating profit for Tribune has dipped 59% since the deal was announced. He wonders,
will the last $4.2 billion in financing be available? And at what rate will it be available when the sale would close 4 months from now in December?
Today, with part of the deal complete, that seems to be the $12 billion question. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Stability, relatively speaking, was the watchword on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Government press officers know that if there's something you want to get out there without it getting too much press coverage, Friday night is the night to do it. And there is probably no better Friday night than one smack in the middle of August. Last Friday, the federal official in charge of something called the Children's Health Insurance Program sent a letter to his state-level counterparts in which he announced the White House is going to make it more difficult for states to expand the program to cover kids in middle-income families. SCHIP, as it's called, has bipartisan support in Congress. In fact, lawmakers voted to expanded right before they left on their August recess. So we've called our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale to help us figure out what the White House is doing. Hi, John.
Hello, Kai.
So as I mentioned, SCHIP is pretty popular on both sides of the aisle in Congress. Why is the White House trying to limit it?
Essentially, they're worried that SCHIP's going to become a creeping government-run single-payer healthcare system. You know, it was created to cover children of working parents who earn too much for Medicare, but not enough to afford private insurance. So more than 6 million children are getting health care from it, and states have been expanding the eligibility to higher and higher incomes. In some states, a family can earn $80,000 a year and have their children covered by government insurance. So that's caused the free market advocates and the administration to worry that SCHIP will displace private insurance for children. It's called crowding out the insurance companies. Basically, that SCHIP could become another big government entitlement program like Medicare or Medicaid.
Cut to the chase, John. How much money are we talking about here?
Well, the administration has proposed for the next 5 years $30 billion for SCHIP, and that barely covers SCHIP's costs under the current enrollment, much less any expansion. Congress is looking at nearly twice that amount in order to increase eligibility.
Congress, of course, is gone for the next couple of weeks. The White House has made this move as they're on recess. What happens next?
Well, this is all going to come to a head next month. SCHIP expires at the end of September. Both the House and the Senate have passed different versions, and they expand eligibility with the support of a lot of Republicans, I might add. Bush is warning that he'll veto this on the grounds that it's a budget buster. Just add SCHIP to the list of looming political budget battles next month as Congress sends the president lots of budget bills that he says he has no intention of signing.
All right, our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale. Thank you, John.
You're welcome, Kai.
That SCHIP program John and I were talking about covers children, as we mentioned. At the other end of the healthcare age spectrum is Medicare. With more baby boomers approaching the age where they'll qualify for coverage, analysts and politicians are wondering how we'll pay for them and where we'll get the trained doctors to look after them. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WGBH in Boston, Helen Palmer has more.
There are 35 million seniors in the U.S. today. There'll be twice as many by 2050, and there'll be only one geriatrician for every 10,000 people over 75. Sharon Levine's training the next generation of geriatricians at Boston University. But Levine says only 4% of newly minted U.S. physicians choose geriatrics.
Family physicians and general internists make much more money in the private sector than geriatricians do, even though geriatricians are fellowship trained.
She pulls out a list of pay scales. Geriatricians earn about $160,000 a year. Gastroenterologists, by comparison, make nearly $369,000. If you were a young doctor leaving medical school with $200,000 worth of debt, which would you choose? Some do choose to work with older patients, though.
Hi, I'm Dr. White Chu. I'm the geriatric fellow working...
Foy White Chu is checking on 98-year-old Ginger Fader, whose legs bleed in.
Well, so what happened here?
I scraped it on the bed.
That's fine.
I must have lost a pint of blood.
Fader lives in a Boston nursing home, Hebrew Rehabilitation Center, where White Chu is getting hands-on experience.
Geriatrics is perfect because you get the most complex cases, and you don't necessarily fix something, but you can make life better.
Only thing I would like to do now is one thing, stand up.
92-year-old Florence Bellis is in a wheelchair since a stroke 4 years ago. Rob Schreiber's her doctor.
Well, we'll try to work with you on that.
Schreiber's the chief physician at Hebrew Senior Life in Boston. He says they deliver low-tech, high-touch care, but U.S. physicians are typically paid for procedures, tests and scans and the like.
We do a lot of care coordination, working in interdisciplinary teams, which requires a lot of time. The way our system is set up, there's not money that's paid for that care coordination and communication.
Schreiber says there's legislation planned to pay for this care, but to date it's founded on Medicare rules that require cuts to offset spending. But experiments show that a team approach to care can save money. Take PACE, a program for very sick, low-income seniors. The PACE Center in South Boston keeps 150 people out of nursing homes and in the community, with an array of services, including entertainment.
You want to stay strong, come to the elderly center. And my name is Lloyd Young, and I'm going to be young as long as I live.
Young's a 75-year-old disabled Korean War veteran. He gets meals, personal care, and a full range of medical services from the center. Medicare and Medicaid pay a monthly rate, says the center's geriatrician, Adam Burrows.
On average, about $2,100 per member per month from Medicare, and we receive, on average, about $3,600 per member per month from Medicaid.
Burrows says 25 states have PACE centers, and dozens more are planned. Everywhere it's been tried, it's helped keep frail elders healthier and saved cash for federal and state governments. And Sharon Levine says Boston University and other medical schools are making sure that doctors in all disciplines get some training in geriatrics.
It's older folks who break their hips. It's older people who have heart disease. So every doctor who has contact with older patients needs to know how to take care of those older patients in the larger sense.
And finally, all of us who are baby boomers will have to take control of our own health, learn to eat healthily, exercise, and manage our chronic diseases. It's essential to stop Medicare from going broke. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
Target's not worried about wider fallout from the credit squeeze. Not yet, anyhow. The discount giant reported robust second-quarter profits today, but executives did say they're going to be a bit more conservative with their sales estimates for the rest of the year. Last week, commentator Benjamin Barber stopped at his local Price Chopper store in Massachusetts to grab some beer and groceries, where he had an encounter that gave him pause.
At the register, a kid clerk muttered, "ID?" "Huh?" I said. "ID, you know, for the beer." It dawned he was carding me. "You think I'm under 21? "Yeah, no, I mean it's policy." "What's policy, to card seniors?" "We got to card everyone. It used to be only to 40. But over in New York, someone ran a sting or something, so now they make us card everyone. No exceptions. You got ID?" I found out later they had carded my 82-year-old stepfather, too. So I called Price Chopper Corporate, and yep, it really is Price Chopper policy. Corporate told me they're worried about litigation, about new state laws like Tennessee's that mandate universal carding for alcohol purchases. First frightened officials close volunteer fire departments, then timid towns take away playground seesaws. Now Price Chopper's carding cardiac patients. Scared of lawsuits? Well, the customer doesn't count. So make the guys on walkers flash their photo IDs. All in keeping with that old un-American tradition of hanging an innocent man rather than letting a guilty one go free. Worried a terrorist may board a plane with a knife? Screen old ladies and take away their nail clippers. Want to catch a few bad guys? Criminalize the whole class they come from. And then there's the corporate practice of infantilizing the staff to protect the company from the occasional mistake. Take away any judgment or discretion, immerse employees in foolish and inflexible rules, and then watch them act just as dumb as you treat them. Blame the government, blame the staff, blame the consumer. But don't go to bat for customers by battling dumb state laws. Don't take responsibility for your staff by training them and backstopping them when they make a mistake. Besides, America's seniors are getting screwed on health care, diddled on Social Security, and double-crossed on pensions anyway. So go ahead. Next time a Vietnam vet or a retired teacher wants a six-pack, card them.
Benjamin Barber runs the nonprofit Democracy Collaborative. You can collaborate with us if you like. Send us your comments through our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, private space travel may no longer be so pie in the sky.
From California to, say, Australia, wherever you want, around the world, you're going to be able to go there for maybe an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours tops.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down 0.2% today, 30 points at 13,090. The NASDAQ ended the day 0.5% or 12 points higher at 2,521. The S&P 500 rose 0.3%, 4 points to 1,449. Target popped up about 1.7% after it released those earnings numbers we told you about. Intel fell 0.9%. United Technologies dropped about 2.3%. Countrywide Financial clawed back the ground it lost yesterday, rising nearly 10% today. Goldman Sachs gained 1.5%. Overseas, Britain's FTSE 100 ticked up 0.1%. Germany's DAX rose 0.2%. The French CAC 40 ended up 0.3% higher. Japan's Nikkei closed up 1%. Investors back home continue to seek shelter in bonds. The yield on the 10-year T-note eased to 4.59%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Wednesday. In Kansas City, President Bush addresses the Veterans of Foreign Wars National Convention. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration holds a summit to talk about devices to keep drunk driving offenders off the roads. Alcohol ignition interlocks force drivers to pass a self-administered breathalyzer to get their cars to start. And the man who brought us Fahrenheit 451 celebrates his birthday. Author Ray Bradbury will be 87. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
It's still summertime, even though Labor Day is only a couple of weeks away, and our first letter is about all things hot. We heard a story last week about a trend among the ecologically conscious called carbon offsetting. That is, for all the carbon dioxide we spew into the atmosphere, it's possible to pay to put oxygen back in by doing things like planting trees, thus offsetting the carbon. Ruth Sidorovich of Las Vegas, Nevada, wrote to say all the enthusiasm about offsets sounds a little overheated to her.
We all believe we're saving all these energy credits, or, you know, it's one person spending it instead of the other person spending it, but it's being spent.
Chances are pretty good we're going to see a lot of money being spent to fix this country's infrastructure, especially since the I-35 bridge collapse in Minneapolis. Commentator Tim Bedore said last week he thinks the government ought to raise taxes to pay for those fixes, and many of you wrote to second that notion, but not Bob Pakrul of Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Unfortunately, bad things happen in the real world. Mr. Bedore's notion that if we all just paid higher taxes, all of our problems would be taken care of is wishful thinking. Instead, we need to hold elected officials accountable to spend our money wisely.
The world's biggest toy company has been having some accountability problems. Lead paint on Chinese-made imports forced Mattel to recall 19 million dolls and toy cars last week. But not everything that was pulled off shelves was yanked because of where it was made. Some of the toys had design flaws in them, designs provided by Mattel itself. Sarah Parris of Lincolnton, North Carolina, wrote to say we left that point out of our report.
In fact, the toys could have been manufactured anywhere, from Montana to Mazatlan, and they still would have been recalled.
If you have comments or corrections for us, online is the best way to let us know. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. The space shuttle landed this afternoon in Florida right on time at 12:32 Eastern. NASA gets its name in the paper when the shuttle flies, but most of the work to get it launched and landed is done by private contractors. A firm called United Space Alliance has a $2 billion agreement with the government to do just that, not to mention the shuttle itself, built by thousands of contractors. But not everything that goes into space does so with the full faith and credit of the U.S. government behind it. Private individuals, rich ones, spent millions of their own dollars building spaceships. In 2004, a space plane funded by Microsoft billionaire Paul Allen flew suborbitally. Author Michael Belfiore says that ship, called Spaceship One, was a landmark for private space entrepreneurs.
What Spaceship One demonstrated was that you didn't need billions of dollars to get to space. So that ship only cost $25 million, which is well within the range of a lot of private investors. So now we've got people like Robert Bigelow building the first commercial space station for under $500 million. It's still a lot of money for one person, but that's only about as much as it costs for one space shuttle launch.
Yeah, but unless your book does really, really well, you're not going to be able to afford to do it. I mean, it's $18, $20 million a pop, right?
Yeah, well, that was before Spaceship One. The price will drop as economies of scale go on, and then we'll have things beyond space tourism, like point-to-point travel on Earth from California to, say, Australia, wherever you want, around the world. You're going to be able to go there for maybe an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours tops, and that's going to be a really big business at some point.
But, you know, our infrastructure right now can barely handle me getting on a plane from Los Angeles to New York and arriving on time without all my bags intact. I mean, how are we going to do it when we're going suborbital or orbital flights from wherever to wherever?
Well, it's like any transportation system. You'll have to have infrastructure in place. And that's what the entrepreneurs are trying to do right now. I can't speak to the airlines. My bags get lost, too. But I think we're going to see a lot of improvements.
There is an element of this that one feels obliged to bring up. You know, even after 30, 40 years in the space business for NASA, it's still not routine. People die doing this. What happens the first time a private spaceship kills somebody?
Well, that's the question everyone's answering. We saw a partial answer to that question just a couple of weeks ago out in Mojave. The folks building Spaceship Two, they did suffer an accident. There seems to have been some problem with the flow of nitrous oxide that resulted in an explosion. We don't know all the answers yet. Investigation's still going on, but three people on their team were killed. Three more put in the hospital. And that really did give the industry pause, you know. But the short answer is that they're really working hard for this not to happen. There's going to be test flights after test flights after test flights. But yes, we'll have to see what happens in the future.
You know, eventually it's not going to be just rich people throwing money at this thing. Safety, obviously, is one thing investors are going to look at. How will these organizations convince would-be investors that it's a going concern?
Remember the early aviation pioneers, they started out flying joyriders from county fairs and things like that for $5 a shot. So first it was just something that rich people, crazy people did. Then once Charles Lindbergh flew across the Atlantic Ocean, well, that proved, hey, we can do this affordably and safely. And that's more or less the point we're at right now. Spaceship One was the Charles Lindbergh. Brian Binney and Mike Melville, the pilots of that, they were the Charles Lindberghs of our time. And we're going to see a lot more people taking this a lot more seriously.
The book by Michael Belfiore is called Rocketeers. Michael, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified approach to fixed income can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today before we go, leading a company out of bankruptcy might well be the high point of a career as CEO, possibly after the low of leading it into Chapter 11. And that may be why Delta Airlines CEO Gerald Grinstein is stepping down. Grinstein announced some time ago he'd leave as soon as a successor was named, and that happened today. Richard Anderson, the former CEO of Northwest Airlines, will get the job. Anderson avoided Northwest's recent bankruptcy challenges. He was working at United Health Group when Northwest got out of Chapter 11 earlier this year. Of course, the announcement is prompting the inevitable speculation about a Delta-Northwest merger. Nothing more on that one so far. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 30 points, 0.2%. The Nasdaq added 12 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 gained 4 points. That's 0.3%. Thanks today to Miguel Macias and Renita Jablonski on our morning report crew. Next time on this program, Rock en Español comes in from the fringe.
The consuming is so large but it just can't be a niche anymore. It's really, I consider it the new general market.
I'm Kai Ryssdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.